Hello and welcome. You're listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. Hello and welcome to episode 183 of Writers Aloud. In this episode, the second of a two-part interview, novelist, non-fiction writer and journalist Rob Chapman continues his conversation with John Sadiq, exploring his move into music journalism, his wide-ranging exploration of 60s psychedelia, and his return to writing fiction. You can hear the first part of this interview in episode 179.
Hello, I'm John Sadiq, and I'm in the straight-talking market town of Todmorden on a very rainy day to talk with music historian, novelist and musician Rob Chapman about his incredible love of music and his need to share that love. He's not the usual kind of fan, full of every fact and figure about his subject. He's a true lover of his art and its sphere. Todmorden lies at the end of a long steep valley that is famous for its many sightings of unidentified flying objects. This seems somewhat appropriate as Rob and I settle in his quiet house, filled with his six-year-old daughter's paintings, to talk about his defining biography of former Pink Floyd frontman Syd Barrett, about Rob's great tome exploring the manifold nature of psychedelia, and to explore his novel writing.
So you were already writing music journalism before the Syd book?
Oh yes, I'd had a period of music journalism, but again, you see, this is what I mean about my non-linear career path. I kind of drifted into music journalism at 40 simply because I could do it. What happened was, I was writing occasionally for dance fanzines in the early 90s because I was very into that whole acid house period. And again, like punk, probably like psychedelia before it, it gave the industry a huge kick up the bum. It was exactly what all the complacency needed. It needed a new way of doing things, new sounds, new ways of organising yourselves to enjoy these sounds. And that was great. But by about 1994, my interest in the dance music culture is levelling off a bit. And you can't go out dancing every weekend when you're approaching 40 anyway. And Mojo magazine started. And I was a bit sniffy about Mojo at first. I thought this is going to be a typical musos, old gits, music was better in the old days kind of magazine, which was not for me at all. And after about three or four issues, I'd be flicking through it on the newsstands thinking, oh, it's not bad actually. And somebody did a piece about the Hyde Park Free Concerts in the late 60s, early 70s, which I attended. And he got a little detail wrong. It wasn't a major detail, but he left a couple of bands out. And so I got in touch with them and said, you know, you might like to know that this was who was on. And I know that because I was there. And that happened a couple of times. I think I had reason to phone the editors just to correct something. And after a few weeks of this, I thought, well, hang on, if I'm phoning them up and correcting them, and I know this stuff because I was there, and sometimes I could actually write it better than the person who's written the piece, I might as well start writing for them. So when I say I drifted into music journalism, you know, I'm not being coy about that. I did, I just kind of, over a period of months, I started writing for them. Mm. I wrote a review of Incredibly Strange Music Volume 1 without expecting payment. I just sent it to them, you know, on spec, and they printed it. And then I did a piece in the back based on an old school friend of mine who had the same name as a famous music industry executive. And I played on the idea that for years I thought that might be the same guy and he'd got famous, you know. And after a while, I'm on the phone to them saying, yeah, I've got some other ideas. And they're already saying, yeah, we want to start commissioning you. You know, will you do a review of this? Will you do of that? Because as soon as they can see, you can write. Well, and so I drifted in. I drifted in and then I enjoyed it for some time. For about 5 or 6 years, I thoroughly enjoyed it.
Marvellous. Let's move on to your other music book. Oh, yeah. It's not really a music book, is it? This is it. Can you, for people who don't know your work, could you say a little bit about your book Psychedelia and Other Colours? I was actually trying to describe it to a friend a couple of days ago, and I found it quite hard to do it justice. I've been very immersed in this book. I actually read it kind of in quite a non-sequential sort of way.
Good, I'm glad you did. Yeah. I wrote it non-sequentially.
Yeah, and I found myself not being able to take a linear line through it.
Oh, yeah.
I found myself kind of, oh, I want to read this bit now. Oh, now I want to read that bit. I'm going to go back and read this. Didn't he say something about... And then I kind of do this with it.
I'm so glad you said that, because I didn't write it sequentially. apart from, I think you probably do need to read the first chapter first and the last chapter last.
Yeah.
But apart from that, yeah, I think you can go anywhere you want to go. And in fact, at times I had a hard job thinking, now, does this theme go in this chapter or should I put it in that chapter? And, you know, that happened. And in fact, at some of the talks I did, because I love going out and talking about these books, I love the promotional side of it. I love the Q&As afterwards, even though you get some mad, batty questions, you get some intelligent ones too. And what I found was this kind of sense of frustration when I did that. Because unlike the Sid book, where there's one person to talk about and one life path, there are myriad themes in this book. And they intertwine and they go off at tangents. And whenever I did a talk, I would get to the end and think, well, I never managed to talk about that bit, or I never talked about that bit. Or someone will say to you in the Q&A, is there anything in there about? And you have to go, yes, and that's a whole other theme. And you then talk a bit about that. Yes, it's vast. That it's it is my big canvas book. I realised that when I came to do it. I thought, Sid slots in here, but it's the same emotional and psychological and aesthetic terrain, but it's a much, much bigger canvas.
So was that what you were trying to present? When you kind of pitched to your editor, or I want to talk about sort of the love of this field, is that what it was?
No, I'll tell you where it came from, because after the Sid book came out, in publishing terms, I'm reasonably hot for 5 minutes, you know, and they want to know what I can do next, because the Sid book did well and got reviewed everywhere and was almost universally well received. Apart from a couple of slightly sniffy reviews, it did really well. When I wanted to do the psychedelia story, I thought, this is bigger. I thought, for a start, it's been done before, but lots of aspects of it haven't been done thoroughly. And my very first words, as you'll probably recall in the introduction, well, the very first sentence is, we go in the scenic route. I hope you're okay with that. The next sentence is, the world really didn't need another book about the psychedelic 60s, not one that tells the same old story about the same old bunch of people.
This is what I wanted to bring up with you, actually, because one of the things that you say...
And I do mean that. Yeah. The world did not need that book being written again.
No, but there's an authorised history, which isn't real. It's not the true organic story of that.
And it's not all the story.
No.
If you're going to talk about the history of light shows, you go way, way back. You find yourself back at in the early pioneers of what was called light music, people built constructing light organs and things like that to project light onto walls with music that went with it. You find yourself back in the 19th century with the invention of some of these techniques. You find yourself then back at Newtonian physics and Newton looking at the idea of experiments with light refractors and colour light experiments. You can go back to candle light shows in Bedouin Arab tents, you know, where people are showing flickering silhouette images as part of the show. People have always played with the idea of light. And you can do that in virtually every chapter. If you're talking about the music hall influence on psychedelic bands in the 1960s, then you go back to the original music hall in the 1850s and 60s. You find yourself going back all the time. And on the English side of things, you see, even now, saying this as I launch into it, I'm aware I'm still only covering, like, this much, 5% of this much, you know. And so I was very intrigued by, there's a kind of melancholy and a nostalgia and an evocativeness in the best of a lot of that 60s music that isn't just all buoyant and up, 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 poppy, poppy, poppy. You know, what do Paul McCartney and John Lennon do when they take LSD? They go back to their childhoods. And they write songs about their childhoods. Lennon in particular, but even McCartney on Penny Lane is evoking certain images, certain psychedelicised images of the world he grew up in.
Yeah, this is something I wanted to kind of pick up with you, actually. This is something I really enjoyed about your writing, is that you seem to have an ability to see things that are actually in plain sight, but nobody else had quite nailed down before. So one thing that was a revelation to me was, and it was you talking about John Lennon and Paul McCartney, is this, when they took LSD, it kind of brought out their inner Scouse. And then with the small faces, it kind of brought out their kind of inner
Cockney.
Their inner Cockney. Yeah. But back in childhood, more innocent times. And I thought that was a really astonishing observation, actually.
Well, the original term, getting in touch with their inner Scouser, does come from Derek Taylor, their publicist, who was a wonderful man. And he died far too young and is sadly missed. And it was actually in the documentary about, it was 20 years ago today, it was the 20th anniversary of Sgt. Pepper's. And that's where he comes out with that line. When the Beatles took acid, they went down through all these layers and they discovered more and more Scouseness. And Syd Barrett did the same. He goes back to childhood in all those songs. He's evoking childhood all the time. And I was fascinated by that. That is a strand that runs through several chapters in the book. Yes. You can't just contain that. The chapter I'm proudest of in that book is the chapter called The Penny Arcadia, because it's going back to those fun times at fun fairs when you were a kid. And again, the whole thing is, where does all this come from? And in fact, I find myself then tracing it back to the 19th century and things like Nicolette Gray, who was the person who retrieved in the 1920s a lot of the 19th century typographical fonts. And in fact, the book originated with Nicolette Gray. As a rule, I never start writing a new music book until I've got something other than the music to talk about. And so I thought, I don't just want to be describing tunes here. I don't just want to be describing psychedelic records. And I found myself back at Nicolette Gray, retrieving all these fonts in the 20s. And that is where the 20th century revival of Victoriana and Edwardiana begins. And that, of course, is crucial. That's where my little light bulb went on above my head. And I thought, bingo, that's it. Because in among all kinds of other things, I see psychedelia as part of that periodic revival of Victoriana and Edwardiana. We go back to those throughout the 20th century. They're in and out, in and out, in and out. In the post-Great War years, people weren't that interested in the Spores of Empire. You can understand why. And that whole revival that begins in the late 20s, it begins with John Betjeman doing it with architecture and Nicolette Gray doing it with typography. And that was my in. Nicolette Gray's book of ornamental fonts, first published in the 20s, republished in the early 1950s, and was a massive influence on a whole new post-war generation of art students. And of course, they're the people who 10 years later are designing record covers, they're doing all the adverts for records in the music press. That's the line.
One thing that was, again, another revelation to me. So I'm reading the Beatles section, and you put the idea forward that the Beatles were a girl band.
Oh, yes.
And it got me to thinking then as well, that kind of, it's not like the secret of the Beatles' success, that I wouldn't be so kind of, you know, reductive to kind of try and say that.
Nor would I.
Yeah, but there's something in there about the Beatles accessing the feminine, and that, as men accessing the feminine within them, sort of opening them up to their audiences. And you say then in an interview that I read with you, in The Quietus, that the Beatles kind of go in and out of masculine, feminine, in and out of masculine, feminine. Could you expand on that a little bit?
They do. I'm proud of that, although I recently caused an absolute storm when I went onto Twitter and mentioned it in that typical glib way you have to when you've only got 140 characters to play with. And one or two people who follow me and I follow them, came back with, "Don't be so foolish." You know, it seemed to really bring out the kind of set in their way orthodox rock critics in some people. You know, there's always this idea, as I suspect they think with a lot of psychedelia itself, of, you know, in the old, you know, to use the Michael Caine accent, you know, it's a load of bloody nonsense, you know. But I'm serious about it. When you listen to those early Beatles songs, for a start, there's three or four tracks on their first LP that were their cover versions of songs that had originally been done by girl groups. The way the Beatles stood at the microphones was two faces close to one mic, one separate. Pop groups didn't do that until the Beatles. They got that from the girl groups, the Crystals, the Ronettes, the Shangri-Las, all those people. And they were clever enough to feminise their songs as well. They were clever enough to be non-gender specific on a lot of those songs. That means that someone else can cover that song, male or female.
It makes them much more likable to me. I was never a Beatles fan.
I was, so, you see. They were there always for me. Too late for them. They were there always for me. And in terms of everything, in ways that I still haven't written about. Because there was one sentence in that Beatles bit, again, I know I'm going to do something else with, where I said that their influence wasn't just in the music, it was in all the incidentals. And by that, I also mean the paraphernalia that came with it. We used to stand at a kettle on a tea tray with the Beatles' faces on it. All to do with the ephemera of the Beatles. It has nothing to do with the music. Because I am a historian, because I'm a cultural historian, and I'm married to a historian. My wife majored in history. She did a master's degree on women's involvement with the Liverpool scene during the Cavern days. So, you know, this is the stuff we talk about in this very room all the time. You know, we're both bang into this. We're both not just historians, we're historiographers as well. We will look at the histories of the histories. I mean, when I said at the beginning of the book, I'm genuinely interested in how this will all play out in 200 years hence. I wasn't being cosmic. I genuinely am interested in that, that one day people will look back on this era, like we might look back at, say, the Renaissance, and we couldn't tell you which decade of the Renaissance something came from. We will just have, we will have other aspects and specificities and generalities to deal with, in the same way that, you know, none of this will make the same sense at all in 200 years' time. I know that is a bit cosmic, I know. It is a bit long-term, you know, but that's me.
So just moving on to your fiction.
Yeah.
You brought out Dusk Music in between these two books, and you have you're working on a novel now, which I think you've just finished the first draft of at this point, is that right?
Mm-hmm.
So where did the movement towards fiction come from for you?
Well, in many ways, you see, you've got this story back to front, because what happened when I got an agent was, I'm on the phone to her, pitching stuff. She says, what have you got? And I'd got novels. What I'd got up to that stage was two or three novels. We're talking about the period just before I got commissioned to do the Sid book. So that's 2005. And she very brusquely said, novels aren't selling, or the particular novels you're trying to sell me aren't selling. What else you got? So I had a plan B, which was a ghostwritten book about a pop star, which I won't bore you with now. And then plan C, because we batted that one back and forward, and she thought, maybe, what else you got? And I had a plan C. Because Syd Barrett had just died, I said almost in passing, I said, well, it would be nice if someone now did the official, you know, a proper Syd Barrett story, did the story properly. She's immediately biting my arm off down the phone. Right, write me a chapter-by-chapter synopsis, this, 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 and this. I did one. She sent me back. Do it again. Do it properly. She's so thorough, my agent. But that's great. I need a kick up the bum occasionally. And that was the reason I discarded the novels. Then I became Rock Guy. To all intents and purposes, I become Rock Guy for the next, you know, 10 years or so. And what I've done since the Psychedelia book, I've gone back to the novels. I had three or four novels in various stages of completion on the back burner. The one novel that had been published, Dusk Music, which was published by Flambard Press, the novel came out, and then no sooner had my novel come out than I kind of drew a line in the sand and stopped doing the novels for a while and started writing cultural history and pop history. And in more recent times, I've gone back to all of the back burner novels. And Dusk Music was about an avant-garde musician. I'm not entirely happy with it, actually, because it had two plots to it. It had a plot now and it had a plot just slightly in the future, and the two stories melded. But the publisher thought the subplot was too weird. And he's right, in a way, it is a bit weird. And so I took that out. And just in a spirit of almost bloody-mindedness, I thought, you know, for example, Jimi Hendrix, who only appears in the original draft as a kind of apparition, as a kind of the guy in the main protagonist knew him, but I don't talk about him directly. And I thought, you know, and I did get a bit harumphy about it. I thought, I bet he'd like some actual chapters about his time with Jimi Hendrix. So I wrote some chapters with his time with Jimi Hendrix. And of course, as soon as he saw those, he said, great, yes, we'll publish it now, it's just right.
Yeah.
But in some ways, I still have misgivings about that. I mean, I'm never entirely happy with anything I do. I'm a perfectionist, and I've never achieved perfection. So I'm never 100% happy with any of those books. But with Dusk Music, in a way, I wish I'd stuck to my guns, and I wish I hadn't put the Hendrix-specific chapters in there at all, and I'd worked on the join between the weird subplot and the main plot. And in fact, the weird subplot, I left that for years thinking, that won't make a standalone novel now. That should have been in there. But of course, you come back to it 10 years later and you think, oh, actually, it does stand alone. Because now I'm so many years on from Dusk Music, I've probably forgotten some of the reasons those things were paired anyway. And I think, yes, this does stand alone. And in fact, I've done that novel. It's fairly short, actually. Funnily enough, it's about the size of Clockwork Orange. 54,000 words, so it's quite slim. And also, after doing a 225,000 word book about psychedelia,
yeah,
and the first draft of that was 300,000, after that I was going back to small scale. There's no way I was doing another book that long, because it mashes your brain too much. And in fact, once you have done a book like that, writing an 80, 90,000 word novel is a breeze, absolute breeze. So the book I've just finished, the one I've done the first draft of, yeah, that's coming at 90,000. Dusk Music, which is still, to all intents and purposes, a back burner novel, and in fact my agent still thinks it's too weird and too unsellable. I suspect if I can get the next one out, it will fall into place and people will want that one, because I know there's something in there. It's not mainstream, it's not a big seller, but I know I've written a book there that's got something in it. So that's how Dusk Music came about. As I said, I was doing novels before. I've now gone back to doing novels.
Yeah.
And also after Psychedelia, I thought, I'm not sure I want to write any more rock books. I think I've said everything I wanted to say in that book. My wife came into the room one night while I was listening to Delia Derbyshire, who was part of the BBC Radiophonic Workshop. She did the original Doctor Who theme. And I was listening to an album of her stuff. And my wife said, you know, what are you listening to this for? And I said, well, this is all for the final chapter of the Psych book, actually. I said, because I'm putting the stuff in there about where psychedelia went that wasn't just psychedelic music. You can argue that some of the weirdest music on television is Radiophonic Workshop background music. And I was making that case.
Yeah, and it goes into children's TV shows.
Exactly.
And yeah,
it ends up on children's TV, which is where the book kind of ends up, you know. And my wife just looked at me. She said, this really is your big book of everything, isn't it? And we both laughed. And I thought, because my wife knows me inside out, you know. We've been together like a million years now, you know. And I thought, yeah, she's right. This is my big book of everything. I thought, I'm putting it all in this book.
Yeah.
You know, and after that, yeah, I don't think I want to write any more rock books.
So do you think the way forward for you now, just to conclude, is maybe small, particular things?
It's novels. And I've gone back to writing about imaginary musicians, funnily enough. I seem to have a small palette, you know. I mean, you can vastly expand on them, you know, because you've got to invent a backstory and a repertoire for them. But I've got this bunch of characters now that I'm reasonably happy with. I mean, I won't plot spoil, but one or two of them do interweave through the novels. Not in a big way. I mean, one character from one novel only appears in a billboard in Dusk Music. He's in Dusk Music, but he's only there on a billboard. And I do that occasionally. An incidental event might happen where one character is in there, but they're going to be full scale in one of the other books. And so it's not, that's why I hesitate to call any of it a trilogy or a quartet, because it's not. But I do like the bunch of characters I've created. I've got this kind of repertory company. That's what I've got now. I've got a cast. I've got an ensemble that I like working with, because I've created them all, and I also know how they interact with each other. And I love doing that. I love it once they walk off the page. All novelists will tell you this. There's that wonderful moment when the character does walk off the page, or they start writing themselves. It gets to a point where you can't say something, because you think no, they wouldn't say that. No, that's me. That's not the character. And that's happened now with this bunch of characters. I know who gets on with who and who doesn't get on with who. I know all their follies and foibles and imperfections are. And that's lovely, because I know where they're all going now. And there's room there to do a few more things with them. So there's a kind of cluster of novels now, about three or four books, I suspect, that they are all, to a larger or smaller extent, going to appear in.
Thank you so much, Rob. Thank you.
Cheers.
That was Rob Chapman in conversation with John Sadiq. You can find out more about Rob on his website at www.rob-chapman.com. And that concludes episode 183, which was recorded by John Sadiq and produced by Kona McPhee. Coming up in episode 184, in another installment of our special Poetry Break series, the poets Jane Draycott and our host Julia Kopus discuss two favourite classic poems, God's Grandeur and Felix Randall, both by Gerard Manley Hopkins. We hope you'll join us. You've been listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. To subscribe to podcasts and to find out more about the work of the RLF, please visit our website at www.rlf.org.uk. Thanks for listening.